Dr. Mae C. Jameson was the first woman of color in the world to go into space, serving 6 years as a NASA astronaut. She flew aboard the space shuttle Endeavour, STS-47, Space Lab J mission in September 1992, and was NASA's first science mission specialist performing experiments in material science, life science, and human adaptation to weightlessness. Dr. Jameson is currently leading the 100-year Starship. It's not a spaceship. It's an initiative seed funded by the Department of Defense's Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, DARPA, which I'm sure you've heard about in relation to the creation of the Internet and so many other things. And this initiative, this project, is meant to assure that the capability for human interstellar space travel to another star is possible within the next 100 years. Talk about visionary. Talk about cool. She's also the founder of the Jameson Group, a technology consulting firm that integrates the critical impact of socio-cultural issues when designing and implementing technologies, such as using satellite technology for healthcare delivery in West Africa. Please, please join me in welcoming Mae Jameson.
Oh, thank you all very much. I am going to move my stuff around here, get everything set up. Thank you so much for inviting me here today and letting me be a part of this. For me, this is a very special occasion. It's a very special occasion because this is the first time I've ever been able to come to an agricultural issues forum, even though, as you'll find out, agriculture and plant sciences and stuff are very dear to me. But also because it's the 10th anniversary of this forum Bayer has been sponsoring, and it's also going into the 20th anniversary of Bayer Corporation's Making Science Make Sense program. And since I started working with them at the age of 13, it's also my 20th anniversary working with this program. So I want to say again, thank you to Bayer and also for you all sharing your time with me. And I'm going to tell you something that I tell every audience that I talk to. This privilege and honor comes because you're sharing with me your time. You see, time is the one truly irreplaceable commodity that we have at our disposal. And while our time is limited, it has infinite possibilities. Okay, we're going to be talking a little bit about STEM today, so you can check my math. There are 86,400 seconds in each day. And each one of those seconds is extremely precious, because we can do with each of those seconds exactly as we please, but we can never get a single one of those seconds back. But it's the choices that we make. It's the decisions of what we do with that time that give it its unlimited potential. So again, thank you for sharing with me your time. So let me tell you what we're going to do today. I was so excited when I heard about the title, Feeding the Imagination Today and Nourishing Tomorrow. It's so much about what I think of the world. And what I set for myself as a task for today is to take you on a journey across space and time through innovations past, present, and those that are going into the future, and the one capability that underpins it all, science literacy. Now, I really am going to do this. What I'm going to do is to talk to you about space exploration and agriculture and science literacy. That's my task, okay? But first of all, let me give you a little bit about my pedigree in science literacy and agriculture and stuff. So most of people think of me when they see me, like, that's the cool picture, right? That's the NASA, that's the space picture. That's the one I like to think of. But here's my pedigree in agriculture and in science literacy. Fundamental now. I made mud pies in Chicago. And I was very good at it. You're laughing because you're saying, where is she going with this? You see, the whole thing about science literacy is that children start out very early trying to explore the world around them. And making mud pies is like looking at drying times. You know, because to make a really good mud pie, you have to get the right amount of liquid in there. You have to get the right drying time. You're starting off on chemical engineering. And then when you add that plant into it to see if it's going to grow, you're in the agriculture deep. Right? Perhaps this doesn't resonate with you, but I'm telling you, what we have to do with children is to maintain that love for science. My other pedigrees in science is I have this father who has who is the most incredible gardener on the south side of Chicago. And he used to compost very early on when it wasn't necessarily the chic thing to do, right? But he used to compost, and he had this stuff called super dirt, right? And everybody at his job wanted some of his dirt because it made the plants grow. And today, I'm one of those people who goes into the nursery, and a lot of the annuals try to hide from me because they know it's not going to turn out well for them. But I still keep going. But here's the other part of my pedigree. I'm an adult who is an individual who has been exposed to the most advanced technologies and the most bountiful economic resources, and at the same time a woeful pitiance of human compassion. And I've been with people who've persevered in conditions that would try all of us mentally, and technologies that have survived outstandingly for thousands of years. As an astronaut, a Peace Corps medical officer, a physician, a chemical engineer, an environmental studies professor, and a business owner and an educator, I see my responsibility is to come and talk and harness some of the ideas and share some of the things with me. Everything that we do, we need to be able to share in the context. When I was a little girl growing up, I grew up on the south side of Chicago, and I used to love lots of things. I played with Barbie dolls, right? I had chemistry sets. I was an original series Star Trek fan. I would lie outside on a summer's night and stare up at the stars with all my young imagination and intensity. I would ponder the theories and the concepts of Big Bang and infinity. I also remember the civil rights movement and the National Guard marching outside my home following the riots of 1968 after Martin Luther King was assassinated in the Democratic National Convention that had been in Chicago. And I remember being afraid for my father who had gone to work that day. I followed the moon landing. I just loved it. And I danced. I wanted to be Judith Jameson. And I looked at space and exploration, and all around me I saw this explosion of ideas and possibilities, this world that was changing very rapidly and a world that I very much wanted to be a part of it. And there were all these different pieces were there. But as a young black girl growing up on the south side of Chicago at that time, I was not necessarily someone's image of who a space person was going to be or who a scientist was going to be. And I had lived in a country and a world that often at that time didn't seem to recognize me for my abilities and my capabilities. It did not take into account my intelligence, motivation, imagination, creativity, energy, perseverance, or talent. It didn't seem to care to want to train me to reach my full potential and develop skills. And at times, it didn't even seem to care that I existed. So one might imagine, one might ask, where did I imagine that I could go into space? Where did I get the audacity to assume that I could go into space when Alan Shepard, Scott Carpenter, John Glenn, Yuri Gagarin didn't look anything like me or seem to share anything in common with me? I could because I was raised by parents who recognized the importance of imagination in moving things forward. I had the pleasure and the honor and the privilege to be with school teachers who would have let me challenge and push the boundaries, who would go out and do the extra work to make sure that I had what I needed. All of these things were part of who I was. When I look around me, I see that that's one of the things that we have to share with children today, that ability as adults to want the best for all kids. And to understand that we all share in the desire to understand the universe around us. It's not just something that's there part of the time. It's something that's fundamentally a part of us. How could I see myself in space when most of the children in the Chicago public schools thought an engineer was a person who drove the train on the L tracks? I could, because I could see myself there. And I knew that it was my right and responsibility to live up my potential and ambitions. And so these are some of the things that I wanted to talk about. These are some of the things that bring me to this place today. That's, again, what you think of. I had to show you a couple of space pictures just to make sure you know that he really told the truth. But I also show them that, you know, there's so many things we bring together. I remember growing up in the 1960s and thinking about space exploration and having to convince a lot of people in my neighborhood that space exploration was really important. And you can imagine this little 8-year-old girl, you know, going around like, this is the reason why we need to do space. One of the things that wasn't mentioned is I was also an African and African American studies major, along with being a chemical engineering major in college. And I remember that there was always this dichotomy. For Julius Nyerere, who was the first president of Tanzania, said, while they were trying to reach the moon, we were trying to reach the village. But here's the thing. Right now, we're able to reach the village because of many of the things that we did reaching the moon. And here's a really important part. For me, space exploration and agriculture go hand in hand. They're the oldest sciences we have. They're the most basic sciences. Because think about it. What allowed us to move ahead is when we stopped being hunter-gatherers, right? When we learned how to do agriculture. And what was the first thing that we started doing when we were learning how to do agriculture? We also used sun cycles. We used the stars and the moons and things like that to figure out how to plant, right? That comes back to another African proverb that says, no one shows a child the sky. The sky is very much a part of us. It underpins so much of what we're able to do these days. It underpinned our technologies in the past. Both of them are cross-cutting. I'm bringing you up and showing you what I'm doing now, 100-year Starship. And the main reason I'm talking to you about it right now is because I want to show you the logo. The logo underneath it has a star called Canopus. That's actually the star in the middle, sort of with a constellation if you wanted to find it. It's 310 light years from Earth. But the thing that's very interesting about Canopus and the reason we chose it, because it connects us in the past. Canopus has been one of the stars it's the second brightest star in the sky. People have planned it according to when it would rise above the horizon for thousands of generations on the Great Rift Valley where we arose. Right now, today, Canopus is used as one of the stars, along with the sun, to guide Voyager, you know, and deep space satellites. And for those of you who are into science fiction, if you've ever seen the movie Dune, The spice planet, ask some of your friends, the spice planet actually circled around the star Canopus. It's really interesting because we go from our past to our present and on to our future. These are the really cross-cutting things. So I wanted to share that with you because as we talk about this, as we look back at the Earth from the moon, we can talk about how these things have made a difference, how space exploration, just by being there, actually makes a difference. Think about space exploration, and I'm only doing this because I want you to understand why these things make a difference and they connect each other. The perspective of being in space, location, location, location. Global positioning satellites, we don't actually think of that when we whip out our smartphones and we're figuring our way from one place to another, but we have space exploration in our hands. We have space technologies in our hands. Weather satellites, they make a difference, right? I'm in Houston, Texas, so we're always very interested in what the weather satellites have to tell. Remote sensing, we're able to look and map things as a result of it. Microgravity, just by being in a place, you can do incredible things with growing various crystals that tell you, various organic crystals that tell you a lot about how the body works or how life works. These are things that are very much a part of space exploration that are used back here on Earth that make a difference to agriculture. Every one of those top check marks are important to agriculture, right? Every one of them. So let's just like take a look and say where we are. If we're looking back, tornadoes, weather, those are things we're very interested in finding out. We can look in and understand much more about weather conversions when we look at them from the vantage point of space. This is one of the images of something called SEVEAR program that NASA uses, which it actually takes remotely sensed data, works with developing countries to help them understand land management, flood control, things like that. Literally, space technologies used for developing countries that are used by people in those countries. It's not the NASA folks who go and then tell them what to do. They literally are trained for it. That is something that we have to think about and talk about. When we look at chemistry, so we can be in a lavender field. What do we use a lavender oil and everything for? All of a sudden, you have something that's very old growing lavender, right? And you need to bring it down to its essence. We look at what it can be used for, whether it's perfume or whether we're starting to try to think maybe it has some pharmacologic value. Those are things that cross-cut each other that very frequently we don't think about. A West African proverb says, if you wait for tomorrow, tomorrow comes. If you don't wait for tomorrow, tomorrow comes. So let me tell you a little bit about more about 100 Year Starship and why we're actually working on it and why I think it's really important when we talk about innovation. 100 Year Starship seeks to ensure that all the capabilities required for human interstellar travel are a reality within the next 100 years. Not that we're going to launch a mission, but all the capabilities that are required. And as you heard, we were seed funded with a competitive grant from DARPA to create a long-lived private organization with this capacity to be able to get humans to another star. And the key word is having humans go to another star. But before we get there, let me tell you the challenge of space, of getting to another star. Because so frequently when we see these movies, you know, they're zipping around in Star Trek, they get it takes them 1 or 2 days. Sir James Jean said, put 3 grains of sand in a cathedral, and that cathedral is more closely packed with sand than space is with stars. We just want to get a little context of when we talk about going from one place to another. So if we think about it another way, when we're looking at 100 Year Starship and saying that we want to go to another star system, we have to change the way we're thinking. And this is sort of space exploration today. We're not going up on the shuttle anymore. We're going up on the Russian Soyuz. But even the new SLS system was still launched. It's basically the same thing. You have a big chemical reaction coming out of the back of the rocket, right? Can't do that to get to another star system. There's just not enough chemical field in our entire solar system to be able to get you there in any reasonable period of time. So we're going to have to rethink things. We're going to have to think about things that maybe look like this. The Empire State Building would fit inside of this, right? Because we're talking about something fundamentally totally different. It's not something that we know. Let's look at another way. So on orbit with humans involved, right, you have to show a picture of you in space. So they're in a space. So it's a transformation of low Earth orbit to interstellar. Anytime you have a picture with Worf, you show that as well. So this is what we're talking about. It's completely different. It's not going to be Worf. It's not going to be like Star Trek. But it's fundamentally different than the way we do space now. Even though that's a space shuttle, I bet you couldn't tell it very much from a picture from the International Space Station. They look very much the same. Our technologies are very much the same. We have to talk about something different. Let me just tell you one more time about what the distance is and why I'm doing this. If we were in Los Angeles and New York City, right, the two poles of the world in the U.S., if we're in L.A. and say the Earth was Los Angeles, New York City was Alpha Centauri, which is our closest neighboring star, which is more than 25 trillion miles away, 4.2 light years, the distance light travels in a year. And if we look at that Voyager, which has been traveling at 35,000 miles per hour, it just went outside of our solar system. It was really a remarkable achievement, and it's still sending information. It would take Voyager 70,000 years to get to Alpha Centauri at this rate. It has only gone 1 mile on that relative journey from L.A. to New York in that time. So again, it tells you we have to do things much, much differently. Going to another star is not like doing anything we've ever done before. In fact, it's the extreme nature of interstellar hurdles that make us do things a little bit differently. It has areas of challenges. It goes across human practice from energy, propulsion, closed-loop systems, navigation, sensing, closing, sustainable agriculture, which is what I want to get us to, that makes a difference. We can't do this with anything else. It's these radical changes that make a difference. We have to change our structure, our behavior, our belief. But for me, that means one thing. It tells me that we're really talking about a journey. We talk about this as an inclusive, audacious journey that transforms life here on Earth and beyond. But the reason why we do that is because it's very clear that all of the capabilities required for successful human travel to another star are what we're required to live here on this Earth. That's what I'm trying to get to. You have to have another way of looking at these things. When you want to come to this, interstellar is black. You know, people talk about blue sky versus black sky. A lot of times in investment, we talk about blue sky, right? It's wide open. We can do anything we want to with it, but we sort of know what it is, right? We sort of have an idea what it is. But the deeper you go into space, as we leave this planet, it becomes black. And we don't know exactly what's out there. But the challenge and the opportunity come from addressing the unknown. That's where the challenge and the opportunity comes from, dressing the unknown. And this is what we're actually looking for when you talk about nourishing the future. When we go into the black, when we go into something we don't know about, we have to be flexible, we have to be open, we have to use existing knowledge, we have to have systems based on radically unexpected partnerships, we have to look at ourselves different, we have to look at self-sufficiency, self-motivation, we have to build a strong set of basic skills and capabilities. There's so many things that are required. Now, if you tell me when we're starting to talk about agriculture into the future, how do we feed the rest of the people? How do we feed the folks on this planet? How we feed them what they want to be fed? Do we, you know, the whole issues around biodiversity? These are some of the unknowns that we're reaching. These are some of the things that we have to pay attention to. And to prepare for going to the black, we have to prepare travelers to successfully address the unknown. So you know where I'm going with this, right? You know where I'm going, right? I'm going to what we need to do with science literacy, because that's exactly what our job is with education. How far can we predict out into the future? I don't think anybody would have predicted what we were looking at over the past 10 years if you had asked folks, you know, 15 years ago, what were you going to prepare graduates for? We probably would not have been able to predict that. But what we can do is figure out how to prepare them for things so that they think differently. In fact, Alice Walker said, it is the nature of this flower to bloom. And when I think about that in terms of students, it means we have to take advantage of their natural proclivity for learning about the world around them. That's what we do with science literacy. Now, I may have seemed like I've gone all around the barn, but what I was trying to do is get us to the point we understand that these things apply almost in any field that we talk about. But there's a fundamental thing that's there. Agriculture, you have to eat. You have to be able to feed people. All the other stuff is nice. But food, water, air, those things are real important. And sometimes we forget them. How do we get there? So I want to talk to you just really some critical actions that promote STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics achievement. And they're really very simple. And I've had the pleasure of working with Bayer's Making Science Make Sense program and promoting these, some of the programs that I've worked with over the years. There's exposure, there's experience, and there's also expectation. Really easy. I call them the three E's. These are things that we can think about that make a difference with students. So expectations. It's basically that children will live up or down to our expectations, right? They live up or down to our expectations. We have to expect children to achieve. So frequently we have kids go into science classes, and we don't expect them all to do well. And in fact, it's not, what's the biggest tagline when you hear somebody talking about science in the news? After they give, they have a really great story, then somebody usually tosses it over to the next person. Well, you know, with science, I didn't understand anything, right? We make it okay to say for our kids that we shouldn't understand science and math. That's not true. Or we imply that science is not in everything, when every time you pick up something, whether it's primping in the mirror in the morning, right, with your cosmetics and things, science is involved these days. These are things that we have to actually pay attention to. Expectations. We have to have things in our classrooms that say we expect our students to do well. We expect them to be literate. Literate doesn't mean that everybody's solving an equation or they're a professional scientist. Literacy means that they're able to read an article in the newspaper about a subject and then vote on it responsibly. That means that they're able to go to their doctors, and when they hear this, all these details and these statistics about breast cancer or colon cancer or prostate cancer, they're able to make a reasonable decision around it and understand that. That they're able to prepare nutritious meals for their children. And then the mainstay, they're able to think their way through the day. We need to expect students to be able to do that. And then we have to do that in terms of girls and boys as well. There's a whole idea of experience. Experience. Because so frequently when we think about how people learn things, we forget that humans basically learn through experience, right? That's how you have your strongest learning moments, is when you do something. Remember going to a city, if somebody drives you there, like you may know your way back and forth from the airport, but if you drive yourself and you get lost a couple of times, you know your way. The best way to learn science is hands-on experiments or experience. The other part you do is you learn the confidence in it. So often people think that, you know, well, this person was just born with this incredible skill, and that's just not true, right? You had to learn it. The most misleading thing that I've ever seen is when you, those movies where they have the boy genius just go into a room with a blackboard and there's all this mathematical writing on the blackboard and all of a sudden they solve the problem. We know that that's not true, right? Because you have to know the nomenclature at least to solve the problem, right? You need to know the nomenclature. So there is more to it than that. We have to get rid of this whole thing where we think that it's just one way of doing this, that there's only one way of doing it. That's just not the answer. It's experience. It makes a difference. I remember when I went to, I was in high school, my junior year in high school, I went to something called the Junior Engineering Technical Society at the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana, and they actually talked about agricultural engineering. That was my first time where I connected the idea of something very deep in the sciences in agriculture and engineering together. It was the most fascinating thing that I'd ever seen, because they made, like, working with cow manure exciting. No, because you're talking about making it into fertilizer. How do you use it for so many other things? And so all of a sudden, the world had become much wider than it would have ever been if I hadn't been there and been exposed to that, which takes us to our next thing, which is the whole idea of exposure. Students need to know and have actually know what things are available before they can be involved in it. These days, when we talk about why we don't have students in more careers, or why does every student want to be a rock star or athlete? It's because that's what we expose them to constantly. You know, the little kids don't come, when the little kid picks up the bug or the snail off the floor, they're not thinking about a rock star. They're thinking about, what's this? And how come it's slimy? That's what they're thinking about. That's the piece that we have to bring back. We have to bring that definitely back to them. So I told you that I had the pleasure of working with Making Science Make Sense over a number of years. This is the 20th anniversary. I just want to show you some of the pictures and how these things relate. From programs where they're challenging students to come up with solutions to their community's problems, we were there, to doing experiments so that kids know that it's okay for experiments and that there can be a part of it, to a program of the biotech program in Berkeley where they took at-risk high school students. Here's the expectation piece. Everybody expected these students to not graduate from high school. So they were brought into a program where they literally had internships with Bayer biotechnology company, and all of the students graduated. Many of them went on to college, and they all were capable of becoming biotechnicians at the end of it. These are students who were expected not to graduate. When you change your expectations of them, they change their expectations of themselves, and they moved ahead as well. From using film and art in the sciences, it makes a difference because, again, we're talking about science literacy. We're not just talking about the next generation professional scientists. The more comfortable we all feel with science, the more likely we are to share it, to have high expectations. Again, art programs, and I think I'm ending with a picture of girls and boys and the whole idea of diversity. I'm going to, can I go back? And I want to start with that because Bayer does a lot of work with diversity, STEM diversity. And let me talk to you about the importance of diversity, because very often the importance of diversity is lost in this world. You see, the output of STEM fields right now, it's leading the way. It's cutting a wide swath in our daily lives through our consumption, our production of energy, toys, healthcare, food, transportation, news, entertainment, you name it. STEM is there. And that path that's being slashed is not necessarily a good path. right? Sometimes we equate just because something is an innovation that is necessarily good, but we're slashing this path anyway. We're defining and building a path with less than a third of the intellectual capability, experience, ambitions, visions, and perspectives to us available to us here in the United States. Because women and most U.S. ethnic minorities and racial minorities who make up two-thirds of our populations are underrepresented in the STEM fields. You know, scientists and those who fund them or support them get to choose things. They get to choose the topics and the phenomenon to be researched. They get to choose the data sets to be analyzed, shelved for later, disregarded, or thrown out as irrelevant or flawed. They get to choose the problems to be solved and the priority with which these problems are addressed. They get to choose the technologies targeted for development and the populations they're relevant to, and this and the means and the methods and standards used to assess the effectiveness of this. And regardless if one assumes that a scientist or an engineer will arrive at the same answer or interpretation of a natural phenomenon once it's chosen for analysis, clearly the decision to use a certain combination of minerals to propel a bullet or to create a beautiful fireworks display is a choice that's dependent upon personal experiences, values, and ambitions. Just the same way the decision to recommend that all adult women get their calcium from milk and dairy products at one point in time, or that the best treatment for breast cancer was a mastectomy, right? Let me just go into the mastectomy one for a second. When I was in medical school a long time ago, the therapy for breast cancer was a mastectomy, right? You remove the entire breast, you get rid of lymph nodes and other things like that. And it wasn't until we got to more women involved that we started going to lumpectomies and radiation and different kinds of less disfiguring therapy, which actually is more effective. Now, I'm going to go back to when I was in medical school. So I used to be fascinated when they talked about testicular cancer. There was a different approach to testicular cancer. We needed to save that testicle at all cost. Right? It didn't matter that they had two and nobody ever saw them. They weren't particularly cute, but we needed to save it at all cost. But it's the difference in the terms of the perspective of people who are looking at it and how the therapies are being raised. We also had the same thing, the interpretation of the territory of a pride of lions. They always assumed it was the male lions until somebody started watching the female lions. It was a female researcher. And actually, what they found out is the territory passes between the mothers and the daughters. And the male lions just sort of fight amongst themselves to see who gets to hang out in that territory. But it's not until you have different people involved who may have different perspectives that you see these things. And I would suggest that as we start to look at what kinds of foods we need, what those things are, that we have a very different place to look as well. So the whole idea these days when we talk about globalization, we have to understand, what does globalization mean? To so many, globalization means that I want to be able to sell my goods and services around the world. And I want various markets and various people to homogenize themselves so it makes it easy for me to sell. On the other hand, globalization could be that I will offer my goods and services so that people around the world can choose the way they want to live, to eat, their culture. One is product-centric and company-centric, the other is people-centric. But in order to be able to understand this difference, you need to have different people working with you, with whether it's in the labs or other places. And in the food industry, I think this is especially acute. It's especially acute because as we get to more and more monocultures of food, then our food supply becomes more endangered, right? It's easier for us to have problems with it. In the past, and I forgot the numbers, but in the past there used to be so many different foods we ate and we grew. As humans, as a species, that range is narrowed down to almost getting to be less than 100 vegetables and plants and things. But if we had more people in there helping to look at it, perhaps we would have a different answer. This is where we're going. These are the kinds of things that we need to look at. This is really important to us. So this whole perspective of diversity, it's not a nicety, it's a necessity. We have to get many people involved in STEM. We have to get many people involved with where the world is going. And again, it starts very early. It doesn't start when you tell a kid in 12th grade or 8th grade, you need to go into science. We need to take advantage of them right here when they have that thirst for knowledge, when they really do want to grow the potato plant in the cup, right? They don't want to look at it really on the computer unless you've given them a computer to look at all the time. They'd much rather be making a mess and moving things around. It's sort of like how they play with the box instead of the toy, because all of a sudden they get to use their imagination and do things. We have to really look at how do we make these things happen. Unless we forget, when we talk about tomorrow and this whole nourishing the ideas, can we go from one thing to another? I'm going to space again. Star Trek, 1966, 1973. We have things that we wouldn't have imagined before that actually are reality much faster than we have thought, from the tablet or the next generation to a tablet in 2010. From the teleconferencing large in 1988 and next generation to, it's like teleconference is just a regular old thing right now, but we had to imagine it differently, to the heads-up displays in Google Glass to where we are right now. Will and Ariel Durant said the future never just happened, it was created. That's where we are now. We're actually in the place where we're creating the future, and we have to think about it. And so the question I would ask all of us, and that I ask myself every day, is what difference does it make that I have a place at the table if I act just like everyone else and I mind my table manners? I need to bring the information, the knowledge I have to bear, even in places where people don't necessarily want to hear it, don't necessarily want to think about it, are people who are all in there and we're right along. We need to actually bring our knowledge to bear. We need to seek the perspectives of others. This is where we are right now. And again, I thank you all for sharing with me your time.